Upon boarding this vessel, I felt such a load of misery fall upon my heart that I almost wished myself a wild beast, that I might escape the pain of sympathy that I felt for the sufferings of the wretched slaves. Of course, they knew some change in their destiny was about to take place, and in their desperate agonies, hope construed that there would be this change taking place in their favor. And when our boats approached the bark, they hailed us with clapping hands and outstretched arms. But who can represent by words the state of the wretches below in the hold? That's from a journal entry of December 1st, 1845, by Master's Mate John C. Lawrence aboard the USS Yorktown. The ship was part of the Africa Squadron formed to interdict slave ships leaving the African coast and coming to the United States. And it comes from the book Voyage to a Thousand Cares. In the conversation to come, we're going to look at the international phenomenon of slavery, slavery in the New World, and how it affected the making of the United States. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is James Sweet, professor of history at the UW-Madison. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
And, of course, in the United States, we're used to thinking of slavery as being a phenomenon in the southern United States with maybe a few slaves in the north, to a thing that goes all the way back to 1619, the year before the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock. But you're saying that it was really a phenomenon of the whole Western Hemisphere.
Absolutely. In fact, in my own sort of research and work, 1619 is it doesn't merit a really important space in the chronology, because Africans had been coming to places like Latin America and the Caribbean almost since after Columbus arrived. In fact, we know the first Africans who came to the New World as slaves were coming as early as the first decade of the 16th century. There were others who were coming even prior to that with the conquerors, the Spanish in particular, nominally as free men. Some of them were also enslaved. But by 1619, you know, when the U.S. was or what would become the United States was first taking its first colonists coming from England, and those folks, you know, first bringing slaves coming to Virginia. In fact, those slaves themselves were destined for Mexico, and there was there was a rivalry between the Dutch and the British, and it was a Dutch ship that actually commandeered a Spanish ship, and there was an exchange that went on between the Dutch and the British, and this ship ended up in Jamestown. It offloaded the so-called 20 and odd Negroes in Jamestown. There were a handful of others who actually ended up going to Bermuda. And so this one ship, which had left Angola, actually had slaves destined for Mexico. Some of them ended up in Cuba. Some of them ended up in Virginia. Some of them ended up in Bermuda. So there's a connectedness to all of this that's really oftentimes lost. In the context of the broader hemisphere, Brazil at this time was during the 17th century. So, you know, from 1600 to 1700. About 500,000 Africans arrived in Brazil during this time. That's the number that totally arrived in the United States over the entire course of the slave trade. So just to provide a broader context, in many respects, what happened in the U.S., particularly in the 17th century, was just a beginning of something for the U.S., but it was part of a much broader process that was already well underway.
So if we go back to the 16th century and the conquistadors, mm-hmm. What purpose would the slaves hold? I mean, because you hear that as soon as Columbus got to the New World, he started enslaving Native Americans.
Right. So, first of all, the other thing I teach and talk about when I'm thinking about sort of the our hemisphere, or thinking about our side of the Atlantic, and it's often lost in the process, is that there were African slaves in Europe even before the arrival of Columbus, right? So I think it's important for people to recognize that the idea of African slavery was one which was already developed even in the European context. So, for example, by the middle decades of the 16th century in a place like Lisbon, as many as 10% of the population was African descended. It's not an insignificant number of people. So this is needless to say that the conquistadores were already accustomed to Africans as slave labor. And generally speaking, they were bringing them as personal body servants. They were accompanying them on these first missions. But then later, of course, what happened was the native populations began a process of decline, mostly by disease. And it was only natural in many respects for the Spanish in particular to turn to African slaves because they were already familiar with them as slaves, and that was where they turned, and they started importing Africans directly from Africa in that first decade of the 16th century.
We associate slaves mostly with plantation culture. Was that the case in a place like Brazil?
Oh, absolutely. There were trends that changed over time in Brazil, but in the first instance, it was sugar plantation labor. And sugar plantation labor in Brazil began in the 16th century, first with Native American laborers, but very quickly with a combined workforce of natives and Africans. And that very rapidly by the late 16th century had turned over into a predominantly African population, most of them coming from West Central Africa, the port of Luanda in particular, where in Angola. And that trend continued with sugar being predominant in Brazil until the first decades of the 18th century, when there was a shift to mining because there was a gold rush in the interior, and so the sugar economy began to decline very quickly because resources were put into the interior, and slaves themselves were also targeted for the interior to work in the mines.
And there was, I guess, already a pretty brisk slave trade within Africa?
Yes. So your opening reading was actually poignant and provocative in a lot of ways for me because, of course, this is not just the hemispheric story. It's also the story of what's going on in Africa. And when you talk about those slave ships, people who arrive into those slave ships, the sort of foreboding that is described in that passage you read, is sort of the middle of the story insofar as many of these people were coming from the interior, oftentimes 200 or 300 miles in the interior, and they were having to make their way to the coast, which itself was oftentimes characterized as, you know, a death march, much as the Middle Passage was also a place of death. So those who made it to the ships, they couldn't know what lay ahead of them. They may have heard rumors, but they certainly couldn't have understood what that experience would entail. But many of them had themselves been survivors and had seen a lot of death already. In fact, historians suggest that perhaps as many people died in those movements from the interior to the coast as who actually died in the Middle Passage. In terms of slavery in Africa, absolutely there was slavery prior to the transatlantic trade. But the complexion of slavery transformed as a result of European intrusions into the coast. And what I mean by that is to say that as Europeans arrived, it changed political configurations, empowered people along the coast, which created conflicts to sort of earlier political configurations. It led to warfare that created more slaves, and those slaves themselves, many of them were targeted for this new trade so that big men along the African coast could enrich themselves with the new products that were coming in. So there are no real good guys in this story. Lots of bad guys, and it's absolutely true that Europeans fed into an old sort of superstructure, at least, that accommodated slavery. But the old system was dictated much more by kinship and relationships of reciprocity than the sort of commodification of people that emerged when Europeans came.
How many European nationalities were involved in the slave trade?
It's a great question. I couldn't tell you the exact number, but you'd be hard pressed to find any people, sort of major European nations, who were not involved. Everyone from the Danish to the Dutch.
Really?
The largest traders, obviously, were the English, and early on the Spanish, and later the Portuguese. The Portuguese were the most persistent, I would say, and the Spanish and the Portuguese. They continued to trade even after 1808, when the slave trade was made illegal by the British, and they were the most persistent, bringing Africans to places like Brazil and Cuba in particular, well into the second half of the 19th century.
So Brazil, at this point, we're talking, obviously, the 16th, the 17th century, mm-hmm. is a colony, a Portuguese colony.
Yes.
And so Portugal had what sort of interest in the lives of those slaves once they got over there?
It's a great question. So
it's complicated too. You'll hear there's an old narrative that suggests that the Portuguese and the Spanish, because they were Catholic countries, there was a tendency towards a more ameliorative form of slavery, a gentle form of slavery, if you will. It's a bad way of putting it, but and the logic there is that the Catholic Church saw Africans as human beings whose souls need to be protected. And there was sort of a symbiosis between the church and the crown, where the Spanish and Portuguese monarchies were invested with the moral responsibility to enforce the teachings of the church. And what that meant was that slaves were Africans, first generation Africans were encouraged by their masters to marry, to be. I mean, church leaders and priests are already on the African coast baptizing Africans before they even left the coast to arrive in
really
ports.
I mean, once they were already commodities.
Absolutely. In fact, what's interesting is there are descriptions of these rituals where the priest would be standing at the entry to a ship and would actually take sort of a large piece of a tree, you know, with leaves and twigs on it, and dip it into the ocean, and, you know, sort of in a mass baptismal way, baptize people, tell them their names, write the name down on a piece of paper, and hand it to them as they got on the ship. So they'd literally be transforming themselves not only into sort of newly Christian people, but they would change their names and sort of recreate their identities at the moment they boarded the ship to go to the Americas. Of course, Africans didn't understand the context or the content of this baptism whatsoever. In fact, there are really interesting narratives of Africans later on in their lives telling stories to people like Pedro Claver, who was a Jesuit priest in Cartagena in Colombia, or what today is Colombia, explaining what they thought the contents of the baptism were. And they thought that, you know, that the water was being put on them that they were being charmed or sort of, you know, so that they would be calm during the passage. Or they thought that they were being prepared to be eaten. There are all these really provocative and evocative stories that Africans told about the meaning of those baptismal rituals. So, you know, the actual context of what this meant was that on the one hand, the Spanish and the Portuguese could sort of pat themselves on the back for doing God's work, but the reality of how that functioned on the ground was something very different.
How did it function on the ground once they got to Brazil?
Great question, too. So it depends on the time period you're talking about and where you're talking about in Brazil. Brazil is a massive country, and in the early years, 16th, 17th century, the vast majority of them were going to the northeast, which was the major sugar-producing region. I make the argument that in the 17th century, in the major northeastern city of Brazil, Salvador, which was where the major sugar plantations surrounded, in fact, the majority of the population was African, and the majority of them were not speakers of Portuguese or any other language except either Kimbundu or Kikongo. The lingua franca of this community was Kimbundu, and it was not unusual at all for particularly whites growing up in this area to speak Kimbundu as well as Portuguese. And so there's a fascinating moment, and I think this was the case across the Americas in certain places, where I think we oftentimes like to think of colonial Americas as sort of incipient nation states. In other words, this is what Brazil would become. But in fact, what they are is little Africas that are being transported from Africa to the Americas. And so the way this plays itself out is that I think the first principle there is language. So people are speaking in their native tongues. They're raising their children in these environments. Their ritual lives are defined by ritual aspects that came from their homelands, particularly ancestral worship. There were rituals that were known as Kilundu, for instance, that proliferated in northeastern Brazil in the 17th century, and that even whites tried to mimic sometimes. So these were really interesting cultural spaces that were inflected with very, very strong and very specific African backgrounds.
Is there a point at which then these Africans outnumber the whites?
Oh, yes. I mean, it very early on. So one of the things I like to repeat all the time whenever I'm you know, giving public talks or if I'm talking to my students, if I have to give a single sort of figure that I think will help people rethink the way they understand the Americas, it's this. Between you know, the beginning of the discovery of the Americas in 1820. So prior to 1820, 3 out of 4 migrants to the Americas writ large, you know, so I'm not just the U.S., but all the Americas, was an African. So 3 out of every 4.
Wow.
Now, this is troubled by the fact that so many were dying, right? So it's a little bit misleading to assume that actually has sort of traction on the ground because so many Africans in particular were dying. Nevertheless, there are these pockets in the Americas. Haiti was another really good example, or Saint-Domingue, prior to the revolution, where Africans were the majority of the population. And when I say majority, they're a plurality. Don't forget there's also an American-born group of African-descended people who emerged fairly quickly in many of these places. But between sort of European immigrants, African-descended people who are, second generation at least in the Americas, and Africans, there were spaces where Africans dominated for long periods of time, and it had significant impacts on the culture and politics of those places.
So in these sugar plantations in Brazil in the 17th, 18th centuries, what kind of life would one of these slaves expect?
Well, I think in the first instance, it's important to know that death pervaded. I mean, I think I've sort of already alluded to this briefly. Lifespans on those sugar plantations for first-generation Africans were less than 10 years. So in some ways, death was a specter. I mean, it was there. And it manifested itself in a variety of ways. It wasn't just that people arrived and died. It was also that where there were the possibilities of families being forged. It's important to know that the majority of the Africans who were imported were men. So 2 out of 3 arrivals to the Americas were men. And those sex ratios skewed in different directions depending on where you were. And like in the interior, in the mines much later, the mines of Brazil, there were some spaces where there were 1,000 men to every woman among Africans. So it blunts the possibilities for family formation. But in those spaces where there were African women and men who came together to have children, child mortality rates were just horrifying. So it was highly unusual for there to be sort of functioning family life, in no small part because of the demographic challenges. Beyond that, I think, you know, if you survived those first years of the sort of death and disease, your life was defined largely by work. The rhythms of working on sugar plantations were such that it was sunrise to sunset. It was backbreaking labor, particularly during harvest seasons. Depending on what part of the sugar-producing apparatus you were working in, there were all sorts of dangers. I mean, I think most people associate sugar or any kind of plantation labor with working in the fields. And in the case of sugar, this is basically a machete and sugarcane stalks. The dangers in those things are mostly the machete themselves and then whatever might be crawling around the field, snakes, things like that. But the other aspect of sugar plantation labor and the production of sugar is that there was an industrial aspect to this even as early as the 16th century. So once you've cut the cane, there's a time constraint under which you need to press that cane and get the juice, and the technology changed over time, but the actual process itself didn't. And what it required were really heavy sort of industrial rollers that were operated either by water power, ox power, or even sometimes human power. And those rollers themselves were dangerous because you put the stalks in, and it was not unusual for humans to go in with them, and they would be crushed and killed. In addition to that, you have these massive furnaces that you're trying to boil off the impurities. People died in those fires. I mean, there were all sorts of spaces in which peril loomed, and the work life of Africans was really horrifying in many respects, and it did define sort of the rhythms of life. Having said all of that, I think what's remarkable to me about the story of Africans in the Americas is the resilience of people in the face of those kinds of challenges. And while you know, while slave masters wanted to define people's lives by work, they enslaved peoples always pushed back, and they brought with them tools to address their maladies in the Americas, and they used them robustly. And I think that's the real story. I mean, I tell my students, you know, there's a lot of death that goes on here, and we can't forget that. And there's a lot of forced and coerced labor that goes on here, and we can't forget that. That is a major part of the story. But history is made by people who push back against the forces that try to define them. And I think that's the real story of Africans in the Americas.
Well, we'll move to another place that's associated strongly with slavery and has a particular place in the history of slavery, and that would be Haiti, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with James Sweet, and we're looking at the phenomenon of Africans in the New World, the entire Western Hemisphere, but we're looking at three or four places in particular. Having looked at Brazil and the sugar plantations there, we'll now move north into the Caribbean and Haiti, which has, as I mentioned, this particular place in the history of slavery, and that it was it the only successful slave revolt?
Absolutely. I mean, it was the only one that succeeded in overthrowing the sort of slave regime, the masters. I mean, it was the only one that formed a new republic in the Americas.
And what's the history of slavery in Haiti? I mean, you mentioned that it actually goes all the way back to the Spanish, the first people in the Caribbean. But
Absolutely.
What made Haiti different?
What made Haiti different was, I think, in the first instance, there was Haiti was a space in which there were small numbers of resident landowners.
This way, would these be French at this?
They're
time?
French, yeah, they're French, and the island was that side of the island, the Haitian, the Saint-Domingue side of the island was progressively developed, and in the early years, there was still land that was underdeveloped, and you had large numbers of slaves, but there were refuges, and there was land where runaways, for instance, could go and seek some sort of asylum. And then there was a pattern that developed in Haiti of what they call petit maronage, and people would run away for short periods of time and then go back. There was sort of a safety valve, I guess you would say, culturally. And for me, what is striking about the Haitian story leading up to the revolution is that there is an immense ratcheting up of the productive capacity of the colony in the years immediately leading up to the revolution. And what I mean by this is to say that there are literally thousands of Africans that are brought in just on the eve of the Haitian Revolution to work on these plantations, in part because people are dying, but in part because there's just this massive expansion. Haiti was producing more than half of the world's sugar during this time, and it was the source of incredible wealth for the French. Coffee, likewise. So it was the jewel in the French Empire's crown, and they kept squeezing it for as much as they possibly could. And what this meant was, so these earlier refuges where there had been spaces, Africans were getting progressively squeezed in all sorts of ways, both in terms of their labor output, but also in terms of the freedoms that had become sort of customary, if you will. And so this revolution, or the revolt that led to the revolution, was in many, many respects, I would say, inevitable, given the ways that the French were employing Africans.
Was there any kind of law in France or any of these colonial countries that at least nominally protected slaves, or somehow provided guidelines for how they should be cared for?
Sure. And this was true as well in both the Portuguese and the Spanish-speaking worlds as well. I mean, there are a variety of different laws, some of which go back to medieval times, which provide protections for slaves. And this goes back to your earlier question, even about the sort of Iberian context and the way that the church protected enslaved peoples. The same was true to a large extent in Saint-Domingue. There were codes that protected Africans from the worst sorts of abuses, at least in theory. But always in practice, there were ways around these things.
Well, for one thing, you're far removed from the governing country.
Precisely. And in the Spanish, there was always this sort of refrain, obedezco pero no cumplo, which is, you know, I obey, but I don't comply, right? And I think the same logic prevailed across the hemisphere where it related to these laws that were proffered, whether in France or even in England, to the extent that there were attempts to try to curb the abuses against slaves across the hemisphere. These were always met with skepticism by planters who thought they knew better.
And this was true in Haiti.
Oh, absolutely. But Haiti remains an interesting enigma in the sense that there's a very fine scholar of Haiti, Michel Roff-Chouillot, who wrote a book, and he talks about the sort of silences of the Haitian Revolution, erasures, if you will. And one of the sort of anecdotes that he has in there that stands out for me is that planters in Haiti, even on the eve of the revolution, they left their windows and their doors open at night. They were perfectly content and felt safe in the environment in which they were living because there had been this sustained sort of agreement. It's a tacit agreement that slaves would do their work, and they believed that they were engaging in a sort of reciprocal relationship and a sort of perverse form of paternalism, I guess you would say. But they were so confident in this that they thought they didn't even need to protect themselves, and it ultimately led to their downfall. But I think it's a demonstration of the extent to which the sort of the corrosiveness of the institution, the fact that even white planters who were acting out some of these abuses felt content and happy. But it also suggests that the slaves themselves, and to a large extent, were playing along with this game for a long time, and I think that has something to do with the legal system and the infrastructure. What they couldn't anticipate was the ways in which the rapid expansion of the economy, was going to bear on Africans in the ways that they would start to push and fight back.
How did the revolution begin?
Revolution begins with a very famous ceremony, actually, called Waikaimon. It's like alligator wood is the sort of translation for this, and it's a small region, actually, or small village spot, really, is what it is, in the northern part of what today is Haiti, where a group of slaves came together in order to plan the first attacks of what would become the revolution. This was, of course, they couldn't conceive what this would possibly turn into. But it was a meeting of a variety of different people, including runaway slaves, freedmen, who supposedly came together and swore a blood pact to keep secret their plans to attack plantations and burn them to the ground, planning this for a particular night. And they swore this blood pact and supposedly slaughtered a pig, drank the blood of the pig. And there's a lot of lore around this. And there have been some people who've argued that the ceremony itself was sort of an invention. But there's enough firsthand account and later descriptions of it to make most scholars believe that there was some version of this that actually unfolded. And there's no doubt that in the immediate aftermath of this, you had the first conflagrations, people attacking plantations, burning down sugarcane fields, and even at that very early stage, engaging in some really horrific kinds of violence against plantation holders and their families. And that tended to be the definition of the rest of the revolution.
So where does it progress from? I mean, they assume that after this pact that the core, the beginners of this, what would become a revolution, followed through on the plan, burned down some plantations,
Right. And what ends up happening is as soon as this happens, more and more Africans begin to abandon their plantations and join forces with these pockets of leaders who emerge very early on. And there are a handful of important leaders. And one of the most prominent, of course, who comes to the fore is Toussaint Louverture. Louverture was himself a man who was purportedly the son of African parents. He spoke African languages. He spoke what becomes Haitian Creole. He was at least partially literate. He had been a slave previously when growing up on a plantation he was a coachman. He raised horses. He raised cattle. So he had some real skill in horsemanship and things like that. And because he had access and he had some literacy, he emerged. And more importantly, I think the skills to lead a cavalry. I think that was really important. And he stole horses, stole weapons from the French, and was able to sort of build through his charisma and leadership a following, and became the preeminent leader of this revolution. And ultimately, by the beginning of the 19th century, was able to consolidate power under his rule, not just in Saint-Domingue, but across the entire island. Indeed, he took the Spanish side as well.
And so the French, and I suppose later the Spanish, did they make any effort to stop this revolution?
Oh yes, there were several attempts. In the first instance, the French sent a large contingent of troops from France, and they were defeated by the Haitian rebels. I mean, this is a truly monumental. It's unfortunate that it is silenced in much of the history of the Americas. In fact, one of the trends, I would say, among historians in the last 15 to 20 years has been to sort of restore the Haitian Revolution to its rightful place in the context of what we call the Age of Revolutions. And the idea, of course, being that the French and the American revolutions are the defining revolutions of the hemisphere or of the Atlantic world. But in fact, you could argue that it was really the Haitian Revolution at the time at least, the one that carried the most reverberations throughout the hemisphere. It was the one that, as Trujillo says, was the most unthinkable at almost every stage, unthinkable that African slaves could possibly engage in this concerted effort to overthrow slavery, or that they could even have a slave rebellion, unthinkable in the sense that they could defeat one of the largest and mightiest militaries and take over the crown jewel of France's empire, unthinkable that they could come together and forge a new government and create their own constitution. So, you know, at every single juncture in this unfolding saga, it truly was unbelievable and unimaginable, I think, for most people in the hemisphere during this time. So I think the lesson that we take away from this is that the fact that the Haitian Revolution has sort of been erased out is as much a function as what happened in the aftermath as anything else. And also, I think, in a sort of systematic erasure of African contributions in the Americas. So it's a combination of those things.
But this revolution took, what, 13 years from 1791 to 1804?
Correct, yeah, 14, 15 years.
So
yeah.
It was a long process. And how did the Haitians fare once they had, in effect, destroyed the economy of the island?
Right, and that is largely a story of what happens in the aftermath. So, I didn't mention this. So, there's a sort of second round of the wars of there's the revolution and there's the war of independence against the French. During the revolution, France actually gave or emancipated slaves in their empire, but then reinstituted slavery after the defeat. And so what happened was Napoleon sent troops into Saint-Domingue to try to retake Saint-Domingue after they had captured Toussaint and dispensed with him. So the wars for independence, which did not last very long because, again, the Haitian forces were formidable and defeated the French. The French also, one of their major downfalls was disease. They suffered tremendously from yellow fever in particular. So there were large numbers who were just unable to carry out their attempt to try to reconquest. But what happens afterward is in some ways tragic. You know, one of the sources of Toussaint's downfall was that he recognized that in order to bring the economy back to solvency, they would have to restore sugar plantations. I mean, that was and coffee plantations, and the island had been devastated. So how do you do that if not to try to bring back the expertise that had created them to begin with? Of course, that expertise found itself in the guise of former slaveholders, and it wasn't likely that those who engaged in that revolution were going to react to that kindly. And so, you know, the leadership of the revolution was between a rock and a hard place. It was a very difficult set of circumstances. Toussaint wanted to negotiate and bring planters back and have them work as paid employees, basically, in the service of their former slaves.
How did that work out?
Not very well.
Not too many takers, yeah.
As you might imagine. Although you'd be surprised, there were planters who did return. They took their amnesties and came back. But the reality was most former slaves did not want to work on those plantations. They wanted simple lives for their families. They wanted to raise crops on a small piece of land. They wanted to feed their families and perhaps have a little bit left over to sell in the markets to get other things that they desired or needed. So much of what happened after the revolution was determined by the desires of those former revolutionaries, and those desires were very different. They were much more private, much more inward looking, and not at all outward looking into the larger sort of world economy. And that was ultimately the you could argue the downfall. I mean, it's no fault of those who engaged in the revolution. It was a heroic and inspired movement that led to that revolution. But the fact that they didn't want to play nice in the world economy is something that ultimately led to their decline. And it was, the United States did not recognize Haiti until late in the 19th century. The French continuously harassed Haiti, engaged in naval blockades. And perhaps the most egregious thing they did was they forced the Haitians to pay them reparations for the land lost during the revolution. That debt that the Haitians were still paying that debt into the third decade of the 20th century, it crippled their economy. I mean, they were literally paying a significant portion of their GDP toward that debt
for 100 years.
Yeah, for 100 years, for over 100 years. It crippled them, and so there's a sort of afterlife to the Haitian Revolution that ironically looks a lot like slavery.
We'll move forward into the United States and maybe Cuba too,
sure,
when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with James Sweet, and we're looking at the phenomenon of Africans in the New World, South America, the Caribbean, and now North America and the United States. And we've looked at the conditions that brought slavery to the point of revolution in Haiti. I read a Civil War history of the American Civil War, and it started out actually with that revolution in Haiti, and made the point that a lot of Southerners were made very nervous by that successful revolution of 1791 to 1804.
Absolutely. There was good reason. The United States and the broader hemisphere have always had these sort of fluid relations. Some of the leaders of the Haitian Revolution had actually fought in the American Revolution, people like Henri Christophe, for instance, who eventually becomes one of Haiti's first presidents. And during the revolution, in the immediate moments in the 1790s, there were large numbers of planters who fled to Haiti. Many went to Cuba, many went to France, but some ended up in the United States, particularly in areas like Philadelphia and New Orleans. But other coastal cities too, like Savannah and Charleston, and as one might imagine, the the news of the revolution in Saint-Domingue was deathly frightening to American planters in the South, and there were attempts to try to prevent Haitian migrants from bringing their slaves because they thought that the infection, the sort of ailment of revolution or revolt would spread to the United States. So there's some fine studies that show the ways in which all up and down the East Coast of the United States, the Haitian Revolution had real reverberations and resonances and led to constraints being placed on slaves locally in North America, too. The story of Haiti in the United States is a fascinating one, though, too. There, in the very early stages of the country's existence, I'm trying to remember the exact year. It was 1793 or 1794. There was a yellow fever outbreak actually in Philadelphia. And it was at once blamed on Haitian migrants, but it was also Haitian migrants who nursed people back to health. And this was at the moment when Philadelphia was the capital of the country, and people like Hamilton and Washington, they fled Philadelphia. And you know, so there's a Haitian story that permeates, I think, through North American history that we often forget. And you know, just connecting it back, the one thing I didn't say when I was talking about the Haitian Revolution is that it's often conceived sort of through the lens of the French Revolution, the sort of liberty and equality stuff, the brotherhood, fraternity. What's important to recognize is in that revolution too, or in that, just as in Brazil, the majority of those rebels were first-generation Africans. Many of them were Kikongo speakers. They're actually dictionaries. There was one dictionary that was produced, a dictionary and vocabulary that was produced by a French planter who had fled to Philadelphia. And he published it when he was in Philadelphia. It was a primer for the future reconquest of Saint-Domingue. And he wrote this dictionary and vocabulary so that French planters would be able to better communicate with their Kikongo-speaking slaves. And he knew Kikongo quite well. It's another demonstration of the ways that in which like white colonials actually became African, and it puts a different twist on that revolution and the way that it impacts on the United States as well.
That's true. There is quite a blending of cultures. I mean, you see it particularly in the South, where a lot of the caretakers for the children of the plantation owners were, of course, from African descent, and a lot of that culture, and even I think some of the way of speaking must have seeped through.
Oh, yes. I mean, to this day, you know, you can go to places in the low country of South Carolina and even Georgia, those coastal areas. Their languages like Gullah and Geechee, which are, I mean, they're indecipherable, I think, to many Americans. If you grew up as I did in that part of the world, I hear it. I can't always follow, but there are certain inflections that are familiar if you've grown up in those spaces. And you're absolutely right. You learn to speak in a particular way that I teach these things with my students sometimes, the sort of language differences, these dialectical differences, which are, of course, they're prominent across the U.S., but the ones in the South are particularly inflected by particular kinds of African languages and ways of speaking.
Americans seem, from early on at least, if not from the very beginning, to have been, as a group, conflicted about slavery. Mm-hmm. I think some of it must have had to do with the Puritan New Englanders, but probably not just that. But between North and South in particular, there was this different way of thinking about slavery. Now, the Northerners didn't rely on slaves nearly so much as the South. Mm-hmm. I suppose that had a lot to do with it.
Right. I think, you know, you have different economic opportunities and different economic situations emerging in each of these regions. And I think that those in large part dictate the ways in which people respond to the question of slavery. But slavery itself, I think the ideas about Africans, their capacities, what their life chances and possibilities were, I think that despite the fact that there were economic differences, that those attitudes were widely shared. And so it is the case that in parts of the North, particularly among Quakers and certain groups of people, that there was at least a nascent message, an early message of a broader sort of human equality, and you find it more explicitly in the abolitionist literature as we move into the 19th century and in abolitionist figures, but you know, for the most part, Norman, I see attitudes being fairly consistent. And now, it's true that slavery itself differentiates these spaces, but the aftermath of the Civil War demonstrates to us that the nation was willing to compromise and actually, I think, sacrifice African Americans on the altar of unity, and that to me at least indicates I wouldn't call it a fatal flaw, but certainly a nagging flaw in our conception of the nation.
Was England the first country to outlaw slavery?
Well, there's an interesting question. I mean, so England outlawing slavery is funny because the English will tell you that slavery was illegal there from after the medieval period. But the reality was that there were people who were bringing slaves to England all during this period. And there are even runaway ads in English newspapers, despite the fact that at least in theory, slavery is against the law in England.
African slaves they were bringing in?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are prominent people, dukes and, you know, people with titled people who own slaves. They're usually personal body servants. So they're not, this isn't broad slavery that we understand in the Americas, plantation slavery. But yes, there were slaves in England, despite the fact that England didn't have slavery. It's a real paradox. And then, of course, in addition to that, you have people who are traveling between the colonies in England who will bring slaves with them. And that was perfectly normal, if you will, for the English. But I think your question was more one aimed at the slave trade. And there's no doubt, yes, England was a leader in abolitionist thinking, first in abolishing the slave trade in 1807, 1808, and then sort of a more general emancipationist tendency moving into the 1820s and 1830s. So abolitionists were crucial in that story, but from my own perspective, I like to make the argument that while the abolitionists were important, and those are the ones we tend to emphasize and we see celebrated, To me, emancipation began much earlier, and the Haitian Revolution was really a principle. I mean, the question you asked me earlier about its impact on the American South is one which can be expanded into the hemisphere. There were people as far south as Brazil who were found wearing, like, on their persons, like as necklaces, images of what they said were the leaders of the Haitian Revolution. So the ideology of sort of freedom and emancipation and taking one's independence was one which was beginning as early as, you know, the 18th century, and by the 19th century was gaining steam across the hemisphere. Even in the United States, the Civil War, again, it's sort of couched as a war of two nations within the nation, right? But you could make an argument that if not for the Civil War, what became the United States could have seen something that looked like Haiti. And the reason I say this is because, unlike other parts of the hemisphere, African Americans had become American really rapidly. In other words, I mentioned earlier the large numbers of Africans that came to places like Brazil and to Saint-Domingue. Relatively speaking, in what became the United States, there were far fewer Africans who came, fewer than 500,000 versus in Brazil, 5 million, just to give some context. And those roughly 450 to 500,000 Africans who came to the United States mostly before 1808, on the eve of the Civil War, had become nearly 4 million. So, you know, it is to say that they were an American population. They were, by this time, they were younger. They were more dynamic. They understood the politics of the place. They were, in my mind at least, at the cusp of creating something, you know, of their own. And it's not the historian's job to engage in speculative exercises, but I do think that there was something afoot in terms of the generational transformation, in terms of the demographic, and in terms of the numbers themselves that would suggest that, you know, the United States was poised for a similar kind of conflagration, if not for the Civil War, sort of taking some of that steam out of it.
How effective was that law? And it was part of the constitutional compromise, wasn't it, that in 1808 – slavery 20 years after the forming of the Constitution,
right,
would be the importation of slaves into the United States would be banned. How effective was that?
It was more effective in the United States, in what became the United States, than it was in the Caribbean and in the Latin America, particularly Brazil.
Was it also made illegal to import them there?
This was the source of many diplomatic disputes between the Portuguese crown, the Spanish crown, and the British crown. The British imposed their will on the Atlantic world by creating this West Africa Squadron, from which you were reading a little bit of earlier. And their major goal was to try to intercept what they deemed to be illegal slave ships. And for them, anything after 1808 was fair game. And so there were diplomatic work going on to try to forge agreements with these other places. But in the interim, the British were intercepting ships and they were taking them to mixed commission courts in places like Rio de Janeiro, for instance. Parts of Africa, islands in between. And basically what would happen is the British would intercept these ships. They would take them to the nearest mixed commission court. There would be a hearing to determine whether these were slaves that were gathered legally or illegally, and invariably they were gathered illegally. In a place like Rio, what would end up happening to the Africans, though, is that they would essentially be indentured for a period of time before they would be allowed then to, in some cases, go back to their homelands. In the United States, to get back to your original question, there were slaves who were still arriving into the United States as early as the very first years of the 1860s. These were few and far between. There was a famous case about which there was actually a book written several years ago of a ship called the Clotilde. In fact, there was an article in the New York Times just 2 or 3 weeks ago about some archaeologists have discovered what they believe to be the remains of the Clotilde. The ship was actually there was a planter. His name was Maher, Timothy Maher, who on a bet, actually, he bet some of his friends, evidently over drinking one night, that he could take a ship to West Africa and avoid the West Africa Squadron and bring slaves back to the United States. You know, this was just on the eve of the Civil War, and there were patrols all in the Atlantic, but then even in the Gulf of Mexico, there were patrols as well. And he was able to avoid them, come up river, offload the slaves, and then he burned the ship. And the descendants of those slaves still live in a town in Alabama called Africa Town. And it's a tragic story in a lot of ways, because they petitioned to go back home, but the government didn't support them. And they did the best they could. Some of the descendants, not just the descendants, some of these very Africans lived into the early part of the 20th century. There are photographs of them, and there's still a sort of memorial to them, if you will. And the town itself is made up of their descendants to this day.
Slavery, of course, ended in this country in 1865, but it went on in other countries well after that, Cuba and Brazil, too.
Correct. So in Cuba, emancipation comes in 1886, and then in Brazil in 1888. The sort of impacts of that are, I think, again, really important for understanding the history of Africans in the Atlantic world. And I mentioned earlier that African Americans become American very quickly. The sort of direct memories and rituals and languages of Africa fade fairly fast over the generations, so that by the 19th century, the beginning of the 19th century, it is an overwhelmingly American population. Whereas in places like Cuba and Brazil, Africa keeps coming. That those mortality rates remained very high, so they had to replenish those African populations. And because the illegal trade continued at a much more rapid pace to Cuba and to Brazil, the effects of that over the post-emancipation period were that Africa continued. So the best example I like to give is from Brazil. In the United States, what happened was African Americans developed a racial consciousness. There were no discrete sort of differences among Africans, but in Brazil, there were still really strong differences among Africans into the 20th century, several decades into the 20th century. So what that meant was the sort of traditions generationally remained discrete. So Afro-Brazilians didn't develop the sort of racial identity that developed in the United States, and that has both positives and negatives, I guess you could say. I mean, you could argue that on the positive side, what that means is people are holding on to the sort of traditional African past, and there's a sort of cultural melange,
And you could argue that the sort of lack of a racial consciousness means that Brazil doesn't have the same, I mean, the way Brazilians would talk about this is that we don't have the same obsession with race that you people in North America do. The reality is that as time has passed, that has developed in Brazil. But it's interesting that those differences, I think, do dictate and sort of resonate into the present.
Well, it's been a fascinating look at a hemispheric phenomenon of slavery, a perspective we don't often get. And thanks for providing it, James Sweet.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you'll join me next time around for University of the Air.